The judge in his long black robe has become a symbol of the American legal system, its goals of impartiality, fairness, and justice. But most of us know very little about what judges do, what their work is really like, how they make their decisions, and what they think about before charging the jury. With me to discuss these and other questions, and to also discuss some of the controversial cases he's presided over, is Philadelphia Common Pleas Court Judge William Maritani. It was Judge Maritani who ruled last September that Central High School must admit the girls seeking to enter. In 1980, he struck down as illegal a city pay raise for 26 officials, including the mayor. Also in 1980, he ruled against the American Booksellers Association, the Association of American Publishers, and the National Association of College Bookstores, who challenged the constitutionality of the obscenity statute, which prohibits the display of sexually explicit materials in stores open to minors. Judge Maritani was an attorney for 22 years in Philadelphia before he was appointed to the bench in 1975. He's the former chair of the Civil Rights Committee of the Philadelphia Bar Association and served for 6 years on the advisory committee to the United States Civil Rights Commission. In 1981, he was appointed by President Carter to the United States Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. Judge Maritani is a Japanese-American who, during World War II, was forced to live in a California internment camp for citizens of Japanese ancestry. When he turned 18, he left the camp and volunteered for service in the Navy. He was rejected because of his nationality, but was soon after drafted into the Army. After the war, he finished law school, then moved to Philadelphia, where he's lived since. In the spring of 1983, he ran as an independent for the state Supreme Court. He was endorsed by the Philadelphia Inquirer. He came in second of 7 candidates, but there was only one opening. Judge Maritani, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Terry, it's a pleasure to be here.
You had watched many judges as an attorney. When you were a lawyer, what did you think made a good judge?
I would think that one important factor is temperament and control of the courtroom as well as knowledge of the law. I think these are very important ingredients.
Are your opinions of what makes a good judge the same now as a judge as they were when you were an attorney?
They're further fortified.
What was the transition like for you from arguing a case to judging the case?
I think the greatest transition from going from a lawyer to becoming a judge, after you get over the initial shock, so to speak, is to understand that you now have a different role, that you must not be an advocate. You cannot be an advocate. Now, this is not to say that a judge does not have prejudices, biases, etc. Every human being does, and I do. But the point is you have to set that aside. And number two, you also have to understand that you have a great deal of power now. And along with that power comes responsibility that must be used the power must be used sparingly, but must be used decisively where necessary. And it is that balance that is very difficult sometimes for a judge to strike, but strike he or she must.
Now you're seeing many attorneys argue their cases. What do you think makes a good attorney from your perspective on the bench?
I think an attorney is good when the attorney is honest and forthright, comes in fully prepared, obviously is aware of the law, and obviously is aware of the facts, and comes in courteous and fully prepared.
There are attorneys who will badger witnesses or use emotionalism to try to sway a jury. How much control do you have, and what tools do you have as a judge to limit that sort of behavior in the courtroom?
Terry, generally speaking, I try to have a hands-off approach to a trial. However, where a lawyer begins to be abusive, and thank goodness there are very, very few of them. Unfortunately, there are some, I must say. Then it behooves a judge to step in and protect a witness or a juror or whomever it may be. That is the judge's role. The judge is an umpire in the field to keep order.
The judge is the person in the courtroom who is involved with the most ceremony. Everyone in the court rises when the judge comes in. The judge is addressed as Your Honor. The judge wears the black robes, has a gavel, and sits in front of the large desk. Is that the
bench?
Bench, of course, right. Do you think that that ceremonial aspect adds something important to the justice system, or is it just unnecessary pomp?
I think it does. There's a caveat to that, however. The judge should not begin to think, well, you know, I am God's gift to the legal profession, or that suddenly that I am better than anybody in the courtroom. A judge must realize that tomorrow, if I'm not a judge, I'm back down with everybody else. He or she must understand that, and don't let it get to your head. But with that admonition, I think the ceremony lends a little bit of dignity. And I think about President Carter, who tried to humanize the presidency, and I don't think the people really like that. They want the whir of the drums and the trumpets and so forth, and hail to the chief being played by the Marine Band. Of course, Mr. Nixon went to the extreme. He tried to dress up his White House staff like little toy soldiers, and we didn't like that. So you have to strike a happy medium.
The jury is comprised of people who are uneducated in the legal system in the way that lawyers and judges are. They might be educated people, but they haven't studied the law, but they are entrusted with the decision of the guilt or innocence of the person in question. Has your faith in juries as a judge been challenged or reaffirmed?
Generally speaking, I have to say that my confidence in the jury system has been fortified. I find that the jurors are quite sophisticated, quite wise, and exercise plain common sense. I frequently refer to it in the courtroom as horse sense. They have an abundance of it. True, there have been a number of occasions, I shouldn't say number, a few occasions, in the criminal courts and in the civil courts where I have disagreed with the juror's decision. But those have been few and far between. This is not to say that I was right. Maybe the jurors were right, but to be candid with you, I did not think they were right. I think they came out with the wrong result. I can recall one criminal case where I thought it was outrageous with their decision. And there have been at least two civil cases where I disagreed with the result. But look, nothing is perfect in a democracy. If we had a dictatorship, it might be perfect, but it'd be miserable.
How do you feel emotionally when you think that the jury is really wrong in the way they've decided?
You know, I have never criticized the jury when they came out with a wrong result, indeed, even an outrageous result. Let me give you one example, and I hope none of the jurors are listening who sat on that jury. There's a little 3-year-old girl who was obviously being sexually assaulted or about to be sexually assaulted because her father had gone downstairs at night temporarily to get some cigarettes. He had locked the door. When he came up, he tried to unlock the door and found the chain lock across the door. Now, obviously, the little girl couldn't do that. And when he had opened the door partway with his chain lock, he saw his little girl screaming and running across and saw this man chasing her. Well, of course, he broke the door down and dispensed a little bit of justice of his own right on the spot. Now, if that's not assault, an attempt at rape and so on, indecent assault, I don't know what else is. The jury found that defendant not guilty. That I was just absolutely flabbergasted by that. Now, I never told the jury that because, you know, these people come in and they do their best. And there are instances where a judge knows that the defendant confessed, but that confession cannot come in because of some technicality. Well, technicality, maybe he was beaten. But it doesn't come in. And so the judge believes, is morally certain that this person committed the offense, and yet the jury may come back and find that person not guilty. And I think it's highly unfair, improper, for the judge to lambast the jury at that point or to criticize them. These folks come in and do the best they know how. Sure, they make mistakes, but don't judges also at times make mistakes unless someone claims he or she is God?
Are there judges who would criticize a jury who he or she felt made a bad call?
I understand some do. I hope they are few and far between.
Is it within the rights of a judge to do that? Is it considered part of the...
Remember, Terry, I said a judge has an awful lot of power. And he should. He or she should. But it must be used sparingly and with responsibility.
I know you've been in the position of, and I know this happened to you with a rape case where you were convinced of the guilt of the rapist on trial, but because of a technicality, you had to find him innocent. You couldn't find him guilty.
I let him go.
What are decisions like that for you emotionally, and why is it important to follow the law, even though it means in this particular instance a guilty person will be going free.
All right. Let me answer that last question first. If the judge does not follow the law, who will? I mean, does a judge now suddenly make the law, or does the legislature make the law? In other words, there's an orderly process. Frankly, there are a number of aspects in the law I don't agree with as a judge, or as a citizen I don't agree with. As a judge, I go along with it. Because if we have a system whereby one person who's elected for 10 years, or in some instances for life in a federal bench, suddenly decides what the law is going to be, then we're going to have chaos in our society. Now, you spoke of the rape case. Yes, on that case, I made the decision because that was clearly what the law was. The case went all the way up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and it was affirmed.
Could you describe the technicality?
Technicality was a question whether or not the police had probable cause to arrest this particular individual. They got the right guy. There's no question in my mind they had the right person. The evidence proved it, and I won't get into it. There's no question about it. But under our law, we cannot go up and pick somebody up merely because you have a feeling that that person is guilty. You must have what is called probable cause. It must be, first of all, the law also speaks about articulable suspicion to stop and to even stop a person. And then you must have reasonable belief that the person is armed and dangerous before you can pat him down. To arrest them, you have to have probable cause. That is to say that the person probably committed some crime. Now, if you're just walking down the street, even though in this case it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and he's all by himself, and about 3 blocks, as I recall, from the scene of the rape, and about 15 minutes following the rape. And I can't blame the police officers for stopping them. As a matter of fact, in my opinion, I said, I don't know what else the police could have done to preserve the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights of search and seizure and so on. And I let him go. And I want you to know that that night, and right after that decision, I just felt sick to my stomach. I felt very bad going home. I couldn't eat that night. And for the next couple of days, I wasn't feeling too well. I wasn't sick, really, but mentally, I was just exhausted that this was the result. But I can't apologize for that because I did follow the law. And if we have a situation where I said, well, darn it, I'm going to damn with the law, I'm going to set it aside, and I'm not going to make new law that I don't care whether it's probable cause or not, they got the right guy, let's do it. Then we're going to have chaos. And there goes democracy, and that's dictatorship. That's dictatorship. It's the start of a dictatorship. And democracy, you know, is, and I don't mean to pontificate, but really, democracy is one of the most inefficient ways to run a government. But thank God we have democracy in this country, free press included.
It's issues like technicalities in which criminals go free that lead many Americans to say, well, our legal system protects criminals more than it protects innocent citizens. I'm sure that a lot of people have said that to you. What's your response?
Well, it's a long response, and I'll try not to make it a long response. The fact of the matter is that it is protecting our system of government, whereby our liberties are being protected. For example, let's assume that the police simply have a hunch that you have a little bit of cocaine in your house. It's a hunch. And they break down your door in the middle of the night, and they invade, and sure enough, they find some cocaine, and they convict you. Is that okay? I mean, look, they found cocaine. So why not go down breaking down a lot of other doors? Marijuana, bootleg whiskey, untaxed cigarettes, where does it end? And do we say, well, look, stop beefing, don't complain, they got him. He had untaxed cigarettes or bootleg whiskey. He brought up from Maryland that did not have Pennsylvania stamp on it, where they found cocaine or marijuana. Look, I think it's much more important for us to preserve our right of privacy and certain liberties, and it's a price we unfortunately must pay, including the freedom of press. And the press sometimes does abuse its responsibilities. There's no question about it. But thank God for a free press.
Do you think that the political beliefs of a judge colors the way they interpret the law?
Not for a good judge. Not if the judge is really playing according to the rules. His or her political belief should have nothing to do with it. His or her political her prejudices should have nothing to do with it. For example, obviously I'm not in favor of rapists. Why, you know, as a citizen, I could tear a rapist apart. I'd like to punch him in the nose. I'd like to do, and that's putting it mildly, as a citizen. But my prejudices cannot interfere with doing my job, and if they do, I should get off.
We've just talked about an instance in which you were certain that the defendant was guilty, but you had to let them off because of the technicality. I'm sure there have been decisions in which there's a great deal of uncertainty in your mind as to the person's guilt or innocence. How do you weigh a decision in the light of that uncertainty?
I follow the law. I know that sounds like a trite answer. Let me tell you another rather happy outcome. There were some seven men charged with rape of two women. And I have to crank in the race factor, because whenever you have differing races, it gets heated up. You know, let's not kid each other. The victims, the two victims were white girls. The seven men charged were black. And I had a hearing before me on what is called a preliminary hearing to see if they should be held over. The girls testified that all seven of them raped each of them. I held four of them, and I let three of them go because there was not sufficient evidence, in my view, to hold the other three. Do you know that, a number of months later, I was walking along the street, and by the way, I did not feel too good about that decision because I thought the three admitted they were there, but they say they were forced by the other four to commit the act. Well, at time of trial, I understand, and I heard about this later, that turned out to be true, and the girls verified it. So there is one instance where I hesitated, but I told myself I've got to follow the law, and did it, and the law turned out right. Those three were rightfully released.
Do you have any process by which you make a decision or environment that you make it in, any kind of almost like meditative process?
I don't
think you let the decision emerge.
I don't think there is any particular mumbo jumbo mystery about it. I think basically you tell yourself you've got to set aside your own predilections, your own prejudices, biases, and I've got them. Believe me, I have them. Not too many, I hope. And then you have an understanding of the law, hopefully. And then the most important ingredients, common sense. And if you have that recipe, somehow, and I hope I do, somehow it works out.
Philadelphia Common Pleas Court Judge William Maritani is my guest. And I'd like to discuss with you some of the cases that you've presided over that have been pretty controversial in the Philadelphia area. Let's start with the most recent, very controversial case, which was the Central High case, in which you ruled that the girls who wanted to be admitted should be, and that the school could not legally restrict itself to only boys. First of all, how are you assigned to a case like that?
How was I assigned the case?
Yeah, how's it decided? Who gets which case?
I wish I knew. I really don't know. I was assigned the case, and it's my job to take it. I knew it was going to be a hot potato because no matter which way I decided that case, I was going to be criticized. Because if I ruled that the girls should not be permitted to attend Central High School, I think there would be a large number of women, and perhaps rightfully so, who would criticize me. I decided the way I did, and I had not only men, but also women criticizing me. It'll be somebody, incidentally, it may be of some significance, it'll be somebody said, I am a 63-year-old woman, and I despise your decision. You know, you're changing the old ways, and there's a place in this society for an all-girls school and an all-boys school, and you're upsetting the cart. I would think that lady in 1920, when the women received the franchise, may have very well made the same criticism. The women were barefoot and pregnant and in the kitchen, And now all of a sudden they're to be politicized and given the franchise, and she might have criticized that. So it goes.
Did you welcome the opportunity to take on a controversial case that you knew would be covered by the media?
No, I can't say. No, I did not give any thought to that. I really didn't. It's just another case. I knew it was going to be controversial. I didn't think it would be as controversial as it turned out to be. But even if it did, that's my job. I can't pick and choose. At least you're not supposed to.
What were the precedents that you found in the law that
supported
your decision? Yes.
Well, as a matter of fact, the precedents did not support the decision, because in 1975, in the case called Wertheimer versus the school district, the identical issue was litigated in the federal courts and went up to the Third Circuit and finally up to the United States Supreme Court. The outcome was that they upheld the separate but equal facilities. In other words, you may segregate by sex as long as they are equal. So we had that problem. So I did not have supportive precedent. However, there was some supportive precedent in this sense. I shouldn't say precedent. Bases, obviously. One was the Pennsylvania ERA, which had been enacted in 1971, although that issue had been raised in the Wertheimer case. Since that time, however, also there have been some developments in the law slightly edging toward equality among the sexes nationally. But most importantly, in the case that was presented before me, there were a number of facts presented which clearly indicated that the two schools were not equal. I'm not talking about the students now, because both students, whether male or female, had to take certain tests, same tests, and they all had to pass. So in terms of mental capability, scholastic ability, they were equal. But after 3 or 4 years in one school, Girls High, as opposed to Central, the academic performance of the girls was lower. Their admissions to colleges was lower. Now, you know, there's something wrong when you start equally at the line, and at the end of the line, they don't end up the same. Well, why? Well, just to point to a number of things. Number one, and this was not brought out in the Wertheimer case, the one that was tried in the federal court, Central High has almost twice as many books in their library. They have a campus that's three times as large. Their school population is only 55% of capacity, whereas the girls, I think, was over 70%, as I recall. Boys have 25 computers, I found, whereas girls only have 12. The boys were allocated $47,000 for computers 1 year, and the girls were allocated, as I recall, something in the vicinity of $12,000. And I could go on and on and on. The quality of the teachers. Of course, if you're fed better in one area, in one school, as opposed to the other. Fed, I mean, in terms of academic menu, recipe, etc. One school, one group is going to end up stronger than the other. And I found them unequal, which also caused some consternation. And I can understand that among the alumni of Girls High. If a person is a graduate of Girls High, you're very proud of it, and you hate to have someone say your school is inferior. But my goodness, you've got to face up to reality in order to have change.
What kind of precedent does the Girls High case create?
Well, I'm afraid not much of a precedent, because it's a decision by a lowly judge. I mean, when I say lowly, I'm not necessarily referring to myself. I don't mean to demean myself too much. I mean that it's decided by a trial judge and therefore is not governing throughout the state. I would hope, however, that by the Newberg case, that's the name of the case, that it would set a precedent that in this state, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, you may not discriminate on the basis of gender unless there are compelling reasons. For example, I'm not suggesting that under the decision we ought to now have co-ed prisons. That's nonsense. or that lavatory facilities ought to be co-ed. That's nonsense. But there has to be a compelling reason why there should be segregation of the sexes.
What would happen if there wasn't a statewide ERA that said that you couldn't discriminate on the grounds of sex? Would that have made
in my case?
Yeah, would that have made it more difficult to rule in the way that you did?
Not for me, to be candid with you. Under the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, as you know, everyone is entitled to equal protection of the laws. Now, as the litany of things that I've just briefly touched upon, this Central High School being a superior high school, therefore, under the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, the students at Girls High were being deprived. They were not being given equal facilities, and therefore they were not given equal protection of the laws, and therefore it's a violation of the law. Even without the ERA, the decision would have been the same, and indeed, I so decided.
Judge William Mulliartani is my guest, and he is the judge who presided over the Central High case and ruled that girls should be admitted to Central High. In 1980, you were the judge on an obscenity case. It was a group of several booksellers, including the American Booksellers Association, the National Association of College Bookstores, the Association of American Publishers, I think Robbins Bookstore in Philadelphia, versus Ed Rendell, who was the DA at the time. And this group was challenging the constitutionality of a statute that said that bookstores could not display obscene materials if minors were allowed into the store. Can you describe briefly why you ruled against the challenge?
Well, because the law was proper. It gave notice. It gave explicit notice as to what was sexually explicit, and therefore was very clear as to its standards. Therefore, no one would be misled by the law. Now, the big difficulty with this particular state statute was, number one, it dealt with freedom of speech. And I must say to you, and this is nothing new with me, it is established law. The First Amendment right is one of the most, the right of free speech is one of the most important rights that we citizens have. And I have to agree with that. However, first of all, obscenity is not protected by the First Amendment, as we all know. I mean, you just cannot go out and spread obscene materials on the newsstands or in the news, in the magazines, although I think there may be a lot of your listeners out there who've looked at some magazines. And by the way, about a month ago, I had never looked at Hustler magazine. I had heard an awful lot about it, so I looked at it. And everything I heard about it is true. It's just trash. And I frankly don't know why that is not obscene, but apparently it's been passing muster. But first of all, in terms of getting back to the minors, a material need not necessarily be obscene to be barred. You and I, for example, as adults, may not buy obscene materials, or at least certainly not sell it. We can have it, strangely enough, but we can't buy it. You can't sell it. So as to minors, however, it need not be therefore obscene. The test is it sexually explicit? Because understandably, they are not mature, and a minor under the act law, by the way, is defined as anybody 17 and under. So they are not mature enough to handle the kind of stuff that perhaps you and I might be, you know, we say, well, so what? What else is new? Now, those kinds of things, and I suppose Hustler magazine, I don't know why anybody would want to read it, but look, everybody, I certainly would want a minor to go around thumbing through Hustler magazine. It just, nothing redeeming in there. And the statute is very explicit in describing what is sexually explicit for a minor, and therefore I upheld it. Now, I upheld it because it would not infringe upon an adult's right to freely read whatever he or she wanted to read, an adult. All you had to do is you had to put this, I'll use a Hustler magazine for a moment. You put the Hustler magazine up on a higher shelf where some little kitty can't reach and thumb through it like a comic book. And sometimes I guess the magazine may have rather sexually explicit cover on it. Well, you're going to just have to cover it, that's all. And it may make a little inconvenient for someone who wants to buy that particular magazine. But look, you have to go in the store. You have to leave your home to go down to the store to buy it. Is that, you know, you shouldn't have to have the magazine fall into your lap before you say it's inconvenient. So they have to go down and they have to go to a separate section of the store where these adult materials are kept. And I don't see anything wrong with that. That's entirely proper. At least I thought so. That's on appeal, by the way.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yes.
There are always rumors of judges who have to rule on obscenity cases in their close quarters, watching pornographic movies, and all kinds of rumors about how they react to that. How should a judge be informed about what kinds of materials exist in society so that they can understand what it is truly that they're ruling on and what the social effects of it might be?
You know, Terry, that raises another point, really, and I'm not don't mean to duck the question. You raise a point that I've often pondered. In the criminal law, an instrument of crime is defined as something that is used by criminals to commit crimes. Basically, I'm giving you the lay definition of it. And I thought to myself, you know, that's nonsense. And I still believe it's nonsense. And this is a decision by the appellate courts, by the way. You know, you, a law-abiding citizen, let's say you're picked as a jury, as a member of the jury, how are you going to know what is customarily used or usually used in committing a crime? You know that guns are, but is a hat pin? Is a slap hammer? Have you ever heard of a slap hammer? Well, you're shaking your head.
No.
Well, that's how they break into cars, you know. They screw this equipment into the keyhole, and they slap the metal bar back, and it jerks the lock out of your ignition and out of your door, and they're in there in 5 seconds, start your car within 10 seconds, they're in the way. If you saw a slap hammer, you've probably never seen a slap hammer, and that's supposed to be an instrument of crime. How are you going to decide that? I've often wondered about that. Now getting back to the matter of obscenity. Well, I guess it's kind of a gut reaction. I forgot, was it Justice Potter Stewart of the United States Supreme Court who said, I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. And I kind of have the same gut reaction myself. Now, my sensitivity might be quite different to other people's, however.
This is a very subjective way of deciding what obscenity is.
Yeah, because there are some things that I see in an R movie that I think are obscene. I'm not an X-rated movie, but the producer, for some reason, throws in a scene in there where a naked woman gets in bed and her naked friend get in bed. They're not even married, usually. And, you know, I'm offended by that because it has nothing to do with the plot, doesn't add anything to the plot, and they just throw it in there to titillate the audience. Now, I'm offended by it. That's a little bit obscene. On the other hand, I just took a trip to Japan last month and also into Red China just one day. And I went to a part of Japan, and by the way, the Japanese are very proper. They're very formal about things, and you are not supposed to break etiquette rules, and they're very strict about it. And yet, if you go into parts of Japan that are off the beaten path, and I did, where you don't see American, European tourists running around. In fact, there are nothing but any tourists I saw were Japanese. And if you go into a toilet, it's co-ed. The urinal is just sitting out there, and a woman just walks right past you, and she goes into a door and closes it, and that's it. And she's not embarrassed. And I figure, well, if she's not embarrassed, I'm not going to be embarrassed. Now, is that obscene? They do not regard that obscene. But there at one time, I guess they don't regard it obscene anymore, but kissing in public might be considered at least offensive, and it still would be today in Japan. Not obscene, but offensive to the sensibilities. Miniskirts in China, and I think it's recently came out in the newspaper about the Western morals corrupting Red China. In fact, I saw something in one of the weekly magazines. Miniskirts are considered offensive. And yet, you know, miniskirts are very blasé here in the United States. So it depends on the morality of that particular culture at any given time. I'm sure miniskirts at one time, certainly in the Victorian age, if you opened up your neck a little bit and hiked up your skirt above the ankle, you would be considered quite a whatever.
I think obscenity is probably an area where the judge's religion, personal lifestyle would really influence the way they ruled on a decision, since it is such a subjective area.
I guess it would. But I think not entirely. I'm sure a great deal of what the judges read is exposed to, et cetera, would help to shape and say, well, this is really not going to offend the reasonable individual out there, or that indeed it will, that the reasonable individual, man or woman, would find this highly offensive.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Philadelphia Common Pleas Court Judge William Mauritani, and we're discussing some of the cases that he's tried and the legal system and how it functions from the perspective of a judge. I forget what year this was, but you ruled against city pay raises for 26 city officials, including the mayor. Since judges are such really political positions in our system, was this a really precarious decision for you?
Terry, that was in 1980, and you're right. It was from the mayor on down. All the city council people, the commissioners, the sheriff, the register wills, and anybody who's anybody was affected by that decision. Again, that case was assigned to me. Again, I want to tell you, I was aware at the front end that that was a loser for the judge. If I upheld the pay raise, the voters would be up in arms. If I struck down the pay raise, as I did, I would have 26 city officials rather upset with me. I must say this, by the way. I think most of them understood. Of course, they were unhappy with it. I would be, too. But I'm not in that position. I'm not an umpire, a baseball umpire, who calls the balls and strikes in order to please Mike Schmidt. If I did, I am corrupt. And there goes the ball game. There goes the American system of justice. If I begin to make decisions based upon, well, butter my own bread or whom I favor, that's corruption, pure and simple. And I think most of those people who were affected understood that after getting over their initial disappointment. I know, for example, and I'll mention one name, President of City Council Joe Coleman. I saw Joe on the street one day, and he, very gracious about it, he warmly shook my hand, smiled, and he knew that I had to make that decision, and he knew that from my standpoint, it was an honest decision. And, by the way, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania upheld it. Yes, tough decision. And I must tell you, frankly, that I think, and I not frankly, I do know there are there's at least one person who is still very upset about it because he told me so when I was running for the Supreme Court earlier in 1983. He came up and told me in no uncertain terms that that was coming back to haunt me. But I would have to do the same thing. That's part of doing the job.
Well, when you ran for the state Supreme Court, you ran as an independent. Why did you not want to affiliate with any of the parties?
Oh, I would have welcomed endorsement by the Democratic and Republican parties. It's just that they chose not to endorse me. I think it's their loss. That's a self-serving statement. But, well, you know, it's a free country. That's all right. They're entitled to do whatever they want. And I don't feel bitter about that. But I didn't get it. But I still decided to stay in the race. And I think a lot of people were surprised that I came in second statewide. They thought, you know, what's this fella doing in the race?
In the American system, there's supposed to be checks and balances between the political and the legal system. But our judgeship system, where the judges are elected, do you think that violates the separation, the checks and balances, since you have a kind of political process through which the judges are there? Do you think that the electoral process is an appropriate one for judges?
No. I'm going to make a lot of enemies on that, I suppose. But, you know, am I supposed to sit here and lie? I won't. I think the electoral process, in theory, is terrific because you're having, quote, the voters elect. Well, that's a lot of hogwash. And I'll ask any listener listening in now, did you know any of the candidates who were running this last time around? If you know, tell me, because some of them I didn't know. Sure, they go in and pull a lever, and they have no idea whatsoever for whom they're voting, whether that person is qualified or not. And so don't give me this business about I'm exercising my franchise. Yes, you are, but blindly. If you had Adolf Hitler on there, I'll bet you they would have voted for him because they would know. Oh, well, they would call him Schickelgruber, and they'd vote for him. So that's a farce. That's a myth. It's a fairy tale. And let's not kid ourselves. I think there ought to be certain minimal standards, a certain checks be made of the background of all candidates. It should be depoliticized as much as possible. And frankly, I don't understand why, for example, and I'm getting a little bit almost idealistic, why the governor of Pennsylvania, for example, and I don't mean necessarily Governor Thornburgh, for whom, by the way, I think he's as about as honest a public servant as we have. And I'll probably make a lot of Democratic enemies on that, but be that, and I think Democrats know that as well. But I dare say that every governor picks as a judge, nominates as a judge if he can. And I say he because we haven't had any women governors here yet, have we? Not Pennsylvania. By political affiliation. And I don't understand that at all, because when that judge gets on the bench, he or she should be completely apolitical. And if he or she is political and still has political strings tied to him, then he or she is not independent. And you must have an independent judiciary in order to make the system work. For example, let me give you an example that we can all understand, perhaps. What if the umpire at the Phillies and Pittsburgh game, baseball game, was owned and being paid by and controlled by the Phillies? Would you have any confidence in his decisions, particularly the close ones? You would not. You'd hold your nose. Even if you shouldn't hold your nose, you'd suspect it. And, you know, let's not kid ourselves. How are judges picked, including myself, by the way, through the political process?
Well, what's an alternative if they're not going to be picked by politicians and if they're not going to be elected by voters? How would a decision be made? Who's
a
judge?
There is no ideal system. You can only look around for a system that is not as bad. And I suppose one of them is the merit selection system, where indeed a judge is given a stamp of approval, a good housekeeping, a seal of approval by an objective body that is not controlled by anybody else. That list would be submitted to, let's say, the governor for appointment. And once that person is appointed and approved by the Senate, by the people elected by the citizenry, by the way, then that person perhaps should simply run for what is called a retention vote. Every 10 years, the citizens would have a right to throw him or her off by saying no, thumbs down, get him off.
There's a lot, I think it's just common knowledge that there are a lot of corrupt judges that, you know.
I don't really think so.
Some, anyways.
Well, I guess there are. I guess there could. Well, you're speaking nationally now. For example, in Chicago, I understand there's some kind of hullabaloo with the wiretaps, and they've indicted some judges there. Well, sure.
Most likely every area has their share.
Sure, Terry. I mean,
a large share, but it does exist.
As long as you have human beings running the system, there are going to be some human beings who are weak, sure.
There are discussions in nearly every field now about competency testing. Should there be any way of reevaluating somebody's continued competence, and if they're no good, a way to get them out of the profession? Should there be something like that, do you think, for judges? Is there an equivalent of that now?
In theory, there is. But I think there's a great danger. That can be abused. Let me give you an example. Let's take my case, for example. Let's assume that with the central decision, I have offended a lot of powerful people. Certainly with that pay raise case, I may very well have offended a lot of people. And they decide to get me and try to remove me because of some kind of incompetence. You can come up, I'm not perfect. I'm sure that sounds fatuous to say that, but of course I'm not. And I have my Achilles heel, and if you really want to attack me, I guess they could find something and try to, if not rig something up and remove me. There's a great deal of danger to that. And let's not kid ourselves. We are capable of doing that kind of thing. So a judge should not be vulnerable to that. However, if you reach a point where the judge is constantly abusive, intemperate, makes some horrible decisions, sleeps on the bench, nods, goes off to sleep, I think, there ought to be some kind of machinery in that. I think that's up to the Supreme Court Chief Justice as a watchdog to take care of that.
Can you tell us briefly where you stand on the speedy trial rule?
Oh, goodness. That's really should be called the prompt trial rule, because the speedy trial is under the United States Constitution Bill of Rights. In theory, it's all right, but, you know, sometimes if you get so enamored with the theory and overlook the practicalities, then the theory won't function, no longer functions. And I do think that sometimes a rule dwells too much on theory and overlooks the realities, the practicalities of, for example, what really the problem here in Philadelphia is. We're just inundated here with criminal cases here. And it's fine to say you bring them to trial within 180 days. But somebody just doesn't understand the kind of logistical problems that we have here. And gracious, we certainly do have them. I know because I used to be calendar judge in the criminal program where I had to, which had been sort of a traffic cop, so to speak, which case goes where, when, and how soon, and that sort of thing. And I had about, I was assigning cases to about 18 judges.
Throughout this interview today, you've discussed the importance of really following the law. What happens when, as a judge, you're confronted with an unjust law? And perhaps the most really obvious example of this is the segregation laws in the South that were on the books very recently. And I know you've served on civil rights commissions, so I'm sure you're very aware of all of this. What's a judge's role when they are ruling on a case and the case is being tried on the grounds of a law that you know is unjust in the first place, but it's a law that's on the books?
Well, if it's a law on the books, unless it violates some other law, such as the United States Constitution, if it violates that, I would not have any hesitation in saying it violated it. If it did not, and I felt very strongly, and I have done this, by the way, I have followed the law. It was clear that I had to follow the law. In fact, one time I remember following a law that was 99 years old, decision by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, but I did not think it had any currency today, but it had never been changed, had been referred to several times as late as 1954, which was quite a few years ago, but still. And I followed it, but in a footnote, I criticized it. Very strongly, I criticize it, indicating very clearly that, in my opinion, that law should no longer be followed. But I followed it while criticizing it, hoping that on appeal it would be overturned.
You have seen probably the best and worst aspects of the American system.
I'm not sure about that.
Well, when you were a teenager, you were interned in a Japanese-American internment camp.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Now, as a lawyer, you've seen the law function well. You've seen it fail sometimes, but
sure.
But on the whole, it sounds like you believe the system functions pretty well. It's just interesting to me that you've seen the best and the worst that America has to offer. I don't know what the question is.
So, what are my views? How do I reconcile the two? Perhaps.
Yeah.
Well, it's the only poker game in town. You know, where else can I go? It's the only poker game in town, and I've got to do the best I can with it, and I can't complain about it because I'm going to try to change it. I'm going to try to straighten it out. I'm going to try to make it an honest poker game, but it's the only poker game in town.
Well, it's really been interesting having you here. I want to
thank you very much
for talking with
My
us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Philadelphia Common Police Court Judge William Maritani.